Hi, I'm Iskander Alamrani. I run the blog Erebus.net, and I'm a journalist based in Cairo. And with us today is Cal from The More Next Door. How's it going, Cal?
Not bad. How are things in Cairo?
Things in Cairo is chaotic and disappointing and as uncertain as they've been for several months. But it's been a quiet day in Cairo because today is a public holiday, 6th of October, the anniversary of the 1973 war, and it's a quiet apart from you know F-16s kind of breaking sonic booms overhead as part of the military parade that's taking place today. But it's a bit of a respite from all the brouhaha about the electoral law, which. As you've probably followed, political parties and the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces still haven't quite decided on, and other issues. I mean, about Egypt's pretty messy and slow-paced transition. How's it in Boston, where you are?
Boston is fine. Certainly not as eventful as any of the events in North Africa recently. But
you've had the beginning of the academic year. That's a pretty exciting time in Boston, at least.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a student, it is. Or if you're university, yeah. But the only thing comparable to F-16 flowing overhead are students stumbling home at night in the streets, that respecting those of us who are older. But I think we should start off by sort of talking about. How eventful North Africa has been this year, as compared to some other parts of the Arab world or the greater Middle East, as people like to call it. I know that if we sort of think about the Arab countries in general, people tend to associate quote unquote the Arab world or the Middle East with the Levant, the Gulf. They think of Saudi Arabia.
It's where everything is always happening. Either it's where the oil is or where. The big wars, Iran, Iraq, Israel, Palestine, are Lebanon, is permanently in the news cycle, and so on. But it seems that this year, finally, North Africa and the Maghreb in particular got its comeuppance. I mean, with Tunisia starting it off, the most unlikely country to have a revolution of any Arab country. And then, we've seen Egypt and Libya and some stirrings in Morocco, a little less in Algeria and Mauritania. Well, we haven't done bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, the North African countries were generally sort of treated in a passive way. There's a fairy tale kingdom in Morocco. There's a beach resort in Tunisia. There's an article in the Financial Times about Christopher Hitchens. About Christopher Hitchens, sort of talking about his the way that he's covered Islamism and the Arab world, and they refer to an article he wrote, I think, in 2007 about Tunisia, which I wrote about on my blog at the time. But you have this idea.
I know, me too. I think we both read the same Financial Times review. I think I know you linked to it. I saw it, and I put it in my links list.
Yeah.
It does raise that 2007 article by Hitchens, who I like as a writer, even if I don't like as his politics, at least of late, was really atrocious.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty rigorous, I wouldn't call it a defense per se, but a gloss piece on Ben Ali's Tunisia. And, you had this bastion of stability. And you had a flurry of articles about Libya, last year, 2009, 2010, et cetera, people going to Libya, prominent Westerners going to Libya and then writing dispatches about how peaceful it was or how much reform was going on, how stable it was, and so on. And all of that's, pretty much been smashed, of course.
It's true, one of the remarkable things in the Maghreb is how successful the regimes, and these are quite different regimes, the monarchy in Morocco, the bizarre splits in the last decade in Algeria between a military junta and an increasingly presidential system, the Ben Ali Tunisia, even Gaddafi's Libya to a certain extent, they really worked well on journalists and analysts coming from two angles. One angle was simply the money, the lobbying that it could buy. I know, you know, as you know, a country like Morocco is always treated as like a darling by the French press, and it's partly you know, what our friend in Kafka calls pastilla diplomacy, after the pastilla dish that's from northern Morocco. It's a delicious dish of filo pastry and chicken or pigeon and nuts and so on. And basically, you know, the tradition of Moroccan hospitality as practiced by the monarchy always convinces through the stomach or through the pocket foreign dignitaries. And on the other hand, this other idea, which I think was more relevant in Hitchin's case, of, you know, these countries have a pretty good record, maybe the best records in the region for women's rights, and therefore they can't be all that bad.
Right.
This kind of basically you give up human rights more generally in favor of a partial progress on the women's rights side, which I always thought was a very narrow way to see things.
And I mean, there's also the case of Hitchin's, but I think a lot of people, you know, you have that these countries took a sort of hard line against the Islamists, right? In the now East Tunisia, you have the sort of Bourguiba era hostility towards, you know, religion and politics and that kind of thing, and of course the Algerians. You have the military as this idea of the military as a secular institution fighting off an Islamist horde, violent, savage Islamist horde, which comes through very heavily in Hitchin's piece on Tunisia. But I mean, it's sort of representative, I think, of the way that a lot of people still write about Algeria, and certainly wrote about Tunisia. The big fear in Tunisia now is, will Mahda take over? Will the Islamists take over? Not, you know, will there be any kind of you know, serious institution building? Although the questions about the process, about legitimacy, et cetera, get kind of thrown out the window when you listen to some Westerners write about Tunisia. It gets reduced to secularists versus Islamists.
Yeah, and it's not very observant of the political debate, I think, inside of Tunisia, which, yes, has incorporated this whole secularist versus Islamist debate. I mean, I was in Tunisia shortly after Ben Ali fell, and I went to a few meetings of some of the left-wing parties, and they are worried. They are worried, right. And they put things like women's rights as a priority. A few weeks later, I was in London and got to meet some prominent Nahda activists, Nahda being the biggest Islamist movement in Tunisia. A son, actually, of one of the major guys who fled in the early 90s, escaped from prison. His father, I think, explained to me that the son explained that the father had escaped from prison and then gone through the desert through Algeria to, and then eventually made it to London. And he was also quite worried, but about the secularists. He was saying, you know, we've had our experience was in the 1990s, the secularists turned a blind eye or even applauded when the regime really cracked down on Islamists. So what we worry about is that we're going to have more of the same of basically secularist backing of Islamist repression.
Right.
But I think, you know, so you have, you first you do need to look at both sides of this and how both sides experience this history, and also look at the fact that actually I think you've had, you know, the initial 3 months of Tunisia's transition were pretty messy, when several members of the old cabinet tried to stay on. But since then, it's gone relatively smoothly, with a real effort at dialogue between Islamists and secularists. I mean, when you look at, like, I think it was last June, the Islamists said, yes, we're completely okay with having 50% quota for women for the next for the Constituent Assembly. I mean, you know, there's signs of goodwill there, I think.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you in that assessment. I mean, I've been translating some of the communiques out of the political parties on my blog, the left-wing parties principally. And you see a change in the sort of the rhetoric and the discourse about the Islamists as well. Some of the communist parties, even the center-left parties, have this kind of aggressive and really... you know, almost anti-religious language that they're using, as late as, you know, 2009 or 2008, and they've changed that tone significantly in the last year or so. and to become somewhat more pragmatic in trying to, you know, reconcile with them, which I think is a positive sign. Unfortunately, though, I mean, you know, you don't necessarily see that reflected in a lot of the way that people write about Tunisia. You know, I was reading an article from, I think, last week or the week before, someplace on the net, and they were basically saying, you know, this transition is, you know, going, you know, miserably. It's a huge flop, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, you know, you have how many months since this uprising took place? It's just sort of like you have to look at it as these things are happening, and you don't really have that happen. You don't have people doing that. You don't have people making the extra effort to pay attention to the nuances in a place like Tunisia, because, you know, especially for North Americans, Tunisia is, you know, small peanuts. You know, nobody really cares.
Yeah.
I think, like, I write a lot about Mauritania. You had the truest bit to say. Nobody cares about Mauritania. But, you know, nevertheless, things happen there. They're relatively. And I think the same is true for a lot of North Africa. People got excited because of blood, or there was the potential for blood, and then moved on.
Moved on very quickly.
Egypt
always remains in people's radar because of Camp David, its proximity to Israel, its size, and its historic alliance with the United States. But it's true that I haven't seen. I mean, I try to follow Tunisia as closely as I can, but it's true that overall, Tunisia was pretty quickly eclipsed by the events of Egypt. I know that Tunisians complain a lot about the way things are going, but I think considering, you know, how important the change is, and certainly in comparison with Egypt, I think they're doing pretty well.
Yeah, and I mean, things could have gone much worse. I mean, you have this. You look on either side of Tunisia, you have Algeria, and you have Libya. You know, I think, you know, just considering the neighborhood and considering it in relative terms, they have a bigger opportunity, I think, than the Algerians, for sure. And they've gone about a bit less dramatically and a lot less painfully than the Libyans have. And internally, they have a lot of things going for them. They're a relatively well-educated population. You know, they have a lot of institutions. They have political parties, which, you know, is not necessarily the case in some of the other countries. So, you know, I also, you know, I'm kind of, I've been miffed by some of the coverage of Algeria, most of the coverage of Algeria, not some. I know we've talked about this before, but I mean, you sort of have this almost flyover kind of assessment of Algeria going around. There's a consensus, it seems like, with a lot of European and particularly American writers, that, you know, Algeria is bound to have some kind of catastrophic awakening very soon. Or that you know, the regime in Algeria is especially more repressive than the regimes next to it, and these accounts of protests and so on that are just, you know, out of relation to every account of what happened, every, you know, report of what happened inside Algeria by people in Algeria, be they journalists or whoever.
How do you feel about what's going on in Algeria now? I mean, I haven't had a chance to go there in the last year, but you know, I followed a little bit, and my first and dominant impression is that people are more afraid first to have the kind of uprisings that took place in Tunisia or Egypt, simply because the memory of the civil war is quite recent, and they're quite aware of the potential dangers in doing that. But I mean, do you agree? And second thing is just that you know, obviously the Algerian state has been responsive since the beginning of this crisis in spending more and doing in various efforts to calm down the anger that exists there. But at the same time, I don't get a sense of a real no resolution anytime soon. I do get a sense of at least not necessarily an looming uprising. I don't think that I don't see signs of, but there is a looming political crisis in the coming in the question of succession,
yes,
which was important in Tunisia and in Egypt. Who's going to succeed? I think in 2014, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, if even lives that long, considering that he's been rumored to be quite sick for a while.
Yeah, he has some kind of a kidney or liver problem. So I think there's but for the first question about fear, right? I mean, you have, you know, people talk about the wall of fear being broken. You know, and in Algeria, I don't think that so-called wall of fear has been broken. I.e., you know, yes, the memory of the civil war is very potent, and I think that's extremely important to understand. I don't think that's everything. I think there's also the fact that, you know, a lot of these countries have had, you know, popular uprisings and then some kind of, you know, basically a coup, right? I mean, my assessment of the Egyptians is they basically had a sort of mini coup where the regime saved itself, was trying to save itself in some ways. And that may be an oversimplification, but I think that the Algerians have had that experience in the past, right? You talk about the Civil War, but even before the Civil War, you had an uprising, actually the anniversary of which was yesterday, 5 October, 1988. You had, you know, economic sort of price riots. People were mad about all kinds of things, but the young people went into the streets and, you know, the army was called in and they killed, you know, 200, 300 people in a pretty short period of time. And you had the initiation of a political transition. You had the revision of the constitution. You had a whole bunch of, you know, reforms that were made by the government in a very short period of time. They had a new new constitution, and in that constitution, they disestablished, you know, socialism, taken out. They abolished the one-party state as such, and that eventually led to elections in 1990, 1992, which, you know, were annulled. And then you have the civil war. You have a coup, and then you have the civil war. People remember that, and I think the political class in particular remembers that period, the transition, mm-hmm. the warning of the transition. When you had in January and December, December and January last year, you had huge youth riots all across the country, almost unprecedented. And what all the opposition parties said was, oh my goodness, this is 1988 all over. They didn't say this looming before, this is 1988 over. I.e., yeah. they weren't so much afraid of the rioting, because there's always rioting. Weekly, if not daily, riots, someplace in every day. That's a feature of the Bouteflika era.
It's not a happy place. I mean, yeah. For the last 10 years, it's happier, a lot happier than it was in the 1990s. But it's still a place with a lot of political frustration, social tensions,
exactly.
And so on.
But that's been managed, and I think, you know, the relativity is very important. Because there's a large part of the population that, you know, compares the last 10 years to the 10 years before. And, you know, macroeconomically speaking, Algeria hasn't done poorly, right? Mm-hmm. They've had, you know, the government has a huge surplus. You've had high gas prices, et cetera. 97% of their, you know, their economy is based on hydrocarbons. So, I mean, they're not doing badly, right? In fact, I think they're actually doing relatively well, you know, compared to, you know, the tone of a lot of the writing about the politics. Economically, people aren't hurting as badly as they have been in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. That's not to say things are well, though. But, you know, you have this idea that, you know, if you, you know, let things slide too fast or too quickly, it will end poorly, right? So there's this fear of transition, and there's this idea that the last 10 years have been stable, the last 10 years have been normal, right? They've been more normal, and that's sort of what the Bouteflika campaign promise is: always normalcy. We're going back to normal. Is stability, is, you know, you look at his campaign banners and all this kind of thing, it's always bright blue, it's always, you know, about serenity, you know, the slogans are about peace, about reconciliation, about resolution, etc. And that mm-hmm. plays with a lot of people. I think Bouteflika's program is, at a popular level, has a lot more credibility than I think a lot of outsiders tend to give to it. Ordinary people tend to appreciate that. On the second thing, you know, the regime response, I think this is extremely important, because most of the writing that you see about this past year about Algeria doesn't incorporate any of the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So you have this you had an uprising in 2001 in Algeria, which is very important, in the Berber-speaking KBV region, right? And, you know, the president was in Nigeria. He was doing a tour of Africa at some time. And so the gendarmerie, which was all over the country because of the civil war, was sort of left over. You know, responded very harshly. A lot of people were hurt, injured, whatever. That uprising began very similarly to the events that, you know, brought about the Egyptian uprising, right? You have a young man, Messinisa Guerma, who was tortured to death in a police station, 17 years old. The police put out a news release that said that he, you know, was a 25-year-old hardened criminal, accusing him of all kinds of perfidy and whatnot. And his parents put out his report card and showed that he was a 17-year-old, you know, high school student who was, you know, an honor student, and whatever. And you had mass youth rioting and people targeting the police and whatnot for several weeks. The lessons that the regime drew from that were that, you know, they scaled back the gendarme presence that part of the country, but they also initiated this huge professionalization effort. This is the buzzword of the armed forces, security forces in Algeria in the last 10 years, is professionalization. So you have this effort to increase the presence of ordinary police, rather than sort of militarizing them in the cities, but also to increase the sort of the prestige of them. So, you know, this effort to clean up their uniforms, or increase recruitment of educated people into the police force, but also to teach them how to respond to angry young men rioting in the street, which is...
Yeah, in a way that's not just brutal.
Yeah, and provocative.
Yeah.
And this is also the lesson that a lot of people have drawn from the 88 crisis, which was that you had a conscript army that was put out on the street demanding riots, and Khaled Nizar, who was the head of the junta, the early phases, early 90s, his memoirs, he actually talks about this at length, saying, you know, the problem was that, you know, we shouldn't have had the army on the streets dealing with civil disturbances, that the soldiers weren't trained to deal with crowds, and that they also weren't, you know, trained, you know, how to fire warning shots. And so they were told to fire warning shots, not to fire on the crowd, but they instead of firing into the air when they fired their warning shots, they fired into the pavement, and the bullets ricocheted, whatever, you know, all kinds of excuses. But, you know, this idea that when you have a crisis like that, you have to respond in a way that doesn't provoke the crowd is something that they've been studying and that they've been sort of preparing for consistently the last 10 years. That's sort of missed. And so if you look at the protests that took place in February, which were, you know, sort of people were, you know, on Al Jazeera and, you know, on Twitter were sort of waiting for the revolution on whatever it was in February. Didn't happen. Nothing really happened because, first of all, not many people showed up because the opposition has its own issues in Algeria. You don't have a credible opposition, frankly. Nobody trusts them. The ones that are elected into government, nobody voted for them. You know, people abstain from voting in Algeria most of the time.
Yeah.
But these guys, you know, the police didn't have guns with them, right? They had batons. And they weren't shooting off. I mean, there was maybe one or two instances where tear gas was used, but they, you know, they roughed people up, but they manhandled them. They didn't beat them in the streets, at least not extensively. And they, you know, it was a response that didn't provoke outrage, popular outrage, and it was done on purpose. And, you know, the media coverage ends up being they beat up protesters or whatever, but they put out, you know, something like 2,500 police officers against like less than 100 protesters in the capital city.
I wonder if it could be argued that maybe the difference, although Algeria in many respects and certainly in terms of the political atmosphere and the economic, not the absolute economic situation, because I don't think you have quite the acute poverty problem that you have in Egypt, for instance, but in terms of the so many young people being unemployed and feeling a lack of opportunities and so on, you know, so while superficially it looks like it would be ready for the same kind of uprising, in fact it's because over the last decade the steam was allowed to get out and things were diffused. You know, it didn't just suddenly explode one day like Egypt did, although no one expected it to. Tunisia did, although no one expected it to. And Libya did, and people thought the regime is far too repressive. It would never allow this. It would never. You know, in these three countries, no one expected this. What unbalanced, what were in the end much more fragile regimes than we thought they were, was a sudden imbalance in between popular anger and repressive capacity.
Yeah,
Algeria that seems to have been taken care of over a longer period of time, so that the steam is never really allowed to build up to the extent that it did in Egypt or Tunisia or Libya.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Algeria is constantly on the low boil, right?
Yes.
So I mean, I don't want to ever say that, you know, possible or whatever. I don't want to make predictions at all.
Of course.
But I think that.
But the catalyst event hasn't happened yet, I guess. You know, you don't have the Khaled Said symbol or the Mohamed Bouazizi symbol.
Right.
You don't have that kind of inspires a wider crowd of people to gather around a single cause.
And you, I mean, yeah, I think that's definitely been the case. I mean, the succession question is actually also very interesting in that same regard, because you have the of course you had Hosni and Jamal in Egypt, mm-hmm. And before that in Syria you had half of them and Bashar. And the unresolved question, and the prediction has been for the last couple of years that Sa'id Bouteflika, Bouteflika's little brother, who's significantly younger than he is, would be the successor. But that was debated aggressively within the regime and within the sort of relevant elite, and rejected out of hand about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, that probably will not happen. The military will not accept that. Algerian political culture mm-hmm. doesn't accept that. But you still have this question of who will succeed Bouteflika, who's a million years old.
I think it's easier for a regime to make it clear that they will not accept a certain person than to come together and openly say it's going to be this person. Because there has to be an agreement within too many parts of the regime. And there's a strong incentive in these regimes, and I think we saw it in Egypt, because even though it was clear for a while that Gamal Mubarak was unacceptable to a certain part of the regime, especially the military, there was no one in the regime was really prepared to put forward an alternative in any kind of official way. And regimes that work in this way, I think, are generally not, they don't get around the table and say, okay, mm-hmm. who's going to be the next president?
Right.
Because they're afraid of fracturing themselves.
Exactly.
Because they're afraid of generating competition within their ranks. Because there's usually an egomaniac president who won't tolerate for that kind of talk.
Right.
Who thinks he's immortal and that he doesn't want to hear about who's going to succeed him. By the way, I just wanted to slip this in just while we're on the topic of Algeria. There was an Al-Qaeda attack, I think, a few days ago now, a week ago, against a military training camp.
Yeah, the military academy, the National Military Academy.
The military academy, yeah.
Cherchel, not just a training camp, this is West Point of Algeria.
Exactly. I mean, the prestigious kind of officer school.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? I mean, is this the return of AQIM after for the last couple of years we heard less about it since the UN bomb, the bombing of the UN was it UNDP office?
Yeah.
I think in 2008?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're definitely committed. They're trying to regain some relevance. I think that it's dire to say the return of AQIM. AQIM has been around, been making attacks against military camps and so on pretty extensively, been active in other countries, in Mauritania and Mali, etc. I think that, they've increased their attacks the last few months. Andrew Leavitt wrote an article about this in the West Point Journal on terrorism, mm-hmm. I think 2 weeks ago or something. Very accurate, very good article. People should read it. And I think there's a couple of things going on there. I think there's been allegedly an influx of weapons coming from Libya, from stocks left open or whatever.
Sure. Into Egypt also, actually.
Yeah. And I mean, in the rest of the region as well. I mean, to Niger and Mali and so on. Of course, you have this other element where there's an opportunity, because you have had troops moved recently to the border with Libya. In the last year, because of the uprising mm-hmm. there, you've had an overall decrease in some of the military presence in certain areas. But I mean, most of the attacks that are taking place, aside from Cherchel and more high profile attacks, they're mostly taking place in areas where there have been attacks historically. So they're reasserting themselves in Fidelia, for example, by making mm-hmm. more attacks. I don't think of AQIM as a strategic, political threat anymore. Sure. Algeria. I mean, it's a security threat, but
they're coming up with the same focused message that they have. I mean, since between 2002 2005, when it changed direction and started focusing less on civilian mm-hmm. targets and really honing in a conflict between the military. Regard their conflict as with the military,
not the people,
with the people or with secular society or.
They transitioned. They became, they were the GSPC then. They became Al Qaeda, mm-hmm. Islamic Maghreb in the 7th.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is I think of this as a sort of dying phenomenon. I don't think of it as a substantial threat. I mean, if you're considering Algerian politics, you have to consider the security premium. You know, the inflated role of the military relies upon there being this kind of conflict, but
Sure.
I mean, I think that the Al-Qaeda issue is extremely overblown when people talk about Algeria. And,
yeah.
And it, to the point where, you know, it's, you know, we're missing, you know, really important
The forest from the tree, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like the most important, I think, one of the most important stories, aside from Al-Qaeda attacking Kershel, is, you know, the fact that the FLN, for example, has been in a political crisis for the last 2 years. Over leadership, you know, the Secretary General Abdelaziz Belkhadem.
We should tell people in case they don't know the historic political post-liberation political party of Algeria.
Yeah, the FLN and the other. There's three ruling parties in Algeria: FLN, Liberation Nationale. You have the RND, which is the National Democratic Rally, which is basically a breakaway from the FLN that was sort of established to give. A multi-party face to the late 90s, mostly military people close to very secularists, etc. And then you have the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan, the MSP, Movement for a Society of Peace. And the FLN, you know, have this guy, Abdelaziz Belkhadem, who's been at the head of the party for like 20 years or something. He's religious. He's seen as a religious guy. He has the prayer adab on his forehead.
Bruce.
Yeah, all that. And, the party has become increasingly religious over that time period, but you know, you have people who say we need a new leader. This guy is no longer credible. He's not being assertive enough in the cabinet. We're not getting the appointments that we want, all that kind of thing. And so, you know, there was violence at the FLN party congress earlier this year, and last year as well. And you know, people are calling for him to resign and all this kind of thing. And so, there are a lot of things shifting around that question of succession. Things shifting around. The character of the regime, because now you basically have two poles in Algerian politics. You don't have a secular pole, I should say. You have a modern, they call it modernist, this modernist pole, which is close to military, semi-secular, but basically establishment, business-oriented, etc. And then you have a sort of more religious tendency, the FLN, the MSP, etc., parking on the Islamic identity. Not necessarily not close to the military, but not identified with the military. And you have a few sort of semi-opposition parties falling out. FLN used to be secular, FLN socialist, no longer socialist, so we're going to go to the Trotskyite party or whatever. But, you know, people are sort of asking, where does all this kind of stuff lead? Like, where are we going to be going?
It's a bit typical of a situation that you have in a lot of the republics, Arab republics, but also actually in a country like Morocco within the political parties, in what's a relatively plural political scene, in that there's a lot of political parties, but it's that the political parties themselves have atrophied, elder leadership is clinging on, and and you just can't get rid of these 70, sometimes 80-year-olds,
right? Exactly.
Who stay on? I mean, it's in a way it's the pattern that's been established by the presidency that's replicating itself down at lower levels of authority.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we should bring this to an end. I think we've gone over our half hour.
Yeah.
The Algeria down, but not out. I think not a lot more complicated than most people, I think, give it credit for, and just it's not an automatic domino effect. The conditions were not the same. Morocco, where there's going to be parliamentary elections later this year. You know, the king has effectively bought himself a second round with now and now has quite cleverly shifted the things onto the political scene, onto the political parties, which the strategy being, well, if things don't change, it's the party's fault now, because there's an election and they can bring new things to the table. I suspect, unfortunately, that the palace will continue running to run things behind the scenes. But again, there, it just doesn't seem quite ripe yet. That crucial something hasn't arrived. It's also possible, you know, who knows, that these regimes will be able to reform themselves enough to keep an uprising at bay. I mean, that's the thing, is that all the regimes in the region have learned from what happened in Tunisia and Egypt. And I think speed is of the essence. If you can't do it in 18 days or a month, you probably, you know, or by breaking out into a full civil war like you did in Libya, for which you need a secure zone like Benghazi was after the no-fly zone was implemented, you probably can't do it at all. And that's something probably our cousins in Syria are thinking hard about right now. And then Tunisia for which I remain very hopeful. I think, you know, the next major test is as at the end of this month when they'll be electing the Constituent Assembly. I'm going to be there actually. I'm going to be traveling there for about a week beforehand, and I look forward to comparing to what I saw in January. And then Egypt right now, I don't even want to talk about Egypt because it's so it's such an unnecessary mess of disorganization and mixed messages. And you know, the elections will take place, but the elections are already irrelevant in the sense that I mean, can you believe that they're going to have these elections where we still don't know what the electoral districts are, but candidate registration starts in a week? So, I mean, our party's planning for, you know, whether they're going to run on combined lists or run. It's been very badly run.
How much do you think deliberate, if any?
I think, I mean, definitely part of it is deliberate in terms of, you know, why, for instance, if this the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, is simply interested in making the transition smooth, why is it insisting on electoral details like whether it should be a proportional list or a single winner district? You know, it proposed half and half, then it went to a third and two thirds. Even though most political parties, the vast majority of political parties, wanted 100% proportional. So it never really gives an explanation, and I think Leon Panetta, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, put it well when after, I think, his visit to Cairo yesterday, he or his spokesman basically said the generals don't seem to know what their own transition timetable is. Anyway, it was something more or less along those lines. I think that they want to. They're suspicious and reluctant to let go of control. They. I think part of it is not just, you know, a pure kind of malicious need to delay the process so that they stay in power as long as possible. I don't think it's so much about that as they don't trust the civilians. They're saying the civilians are incompetent and that the country is too close to kind of collapse or something, or to whether economic, security, or otherwise. To let go. You know, this is the way the military has thought about the country for the last 60 years, is that they're the only ones who can, you know, get their stuff together and actually do things, which actually happens to be completely untrue, as we've seen over the last six months. But, you know, they think of themselves as last man standing, and they basically don't trust, I think, civilians, politicians, people from political parties, to do this. So they want to micromanage.
They're afraid that the wrong people will get it.
I think it's more than the wrong people. It's more than, let's say, they're afraid of the Muslim Brothers or some radicals who will go to war against Israel and drag the country into some catastrophe. I mean, I think it's partly that, but I think it's also they don't think that politicians, you know, if we're talking about transition to civilian rule, they don't think that politicians can run the country. They don't think that the politicians are tough enough. They don't think that they have what it takes. They don't think that they'll have the respect of the people. And, you know, it's depressing because the transition has been so bad and badly managed. Just yesterday, I went to do some grocery shopping at my local street market where I get vegetables. And you know, some guy runs up to the greengrocer and says, We're sorry, Mr. President, which is the name of the Facebook group that's supporting Mubarak. And my greengrocer answers back, Ahna Safina Rais. And so I talk to him, what's up with that? Why are you saying we're sorry, Mr. President? And he was saying, things under Mubarak were so much better. He's a great guy. It's really unfair what happened to him. And, you know, the people call this revolution. This is not a revolution. This is chaos. This is complete, you don't have, if you want something, you don't just take to the streets and take and start protests. You know, can we have a little organization? So, and this is a really kind of poor guy who's not a stakeholder in the old regime. He's a poor guy who probably suffered from the policies of the old regime, but he hasn't seen anything that gives him any sense of his life improving in the last 6 months. And I think that's the big loss. I'm not concerned so much about the result of the elections and so on. I'm concerned about the collective lack of faith in this uprising having been worth it.
Right. And does that give the military some kind of opportunity, you think?
You know, just today again, I mean, the headline of the newspaper of Ahram, I think, was something along the lines of there will not be a military candidate for the presidency. Mm. So for once they're being more or less ambiguous. Although, of course, you know, having lived in Egypt for a long time, sometimes you have to believe the opposite of what Al Ahram says. I still don't see that as being the case. But I think they have to find the right civilian candidate. You know, for the presidency, I think it's the presidency that's going to matter in the short term. I mean, not that parliament is not important, but the presidency is going to set the tone. And when the president is elected, which is one of the things that hasn't been decided, and could be as far as mid-2013, some of the top presidential candidates just issued a statement demanding that it be by next June, which is already a lot later than people thought it would be. But when the president is elected, that's when the military goes back to the barracks. You know, and institutionally, officially, the president is the commander of the armed forces, so he'll be their boss, and he'll be presumably a civilian.
A lot of interesting variables at play.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's leave it at that, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Have a good one.
All right, take care.